Please report it. Good morning. My name is Paul Adams. I will make the first argument for the petitioner, and the remaining 10 minutes will be reserved for my associate, Ms. Jamie King. Your Honor, this case involves an appeal over a dispute with the effect of a restrictive covenant filed on land in Dallas, Texas. The suit was originally commenced by the respondent here, Garcia, as plaintiff in the trial court for a declaratory judgment to declare and determine that a restrictive covenant filed in a correction deed by Sneyden trustee was of no force or effect on Garcia's title. Both parties filed motions for summary judgment in the trial court, and the trial court, after considering the summary judgment evidence, granted the summary judgment on behalf of Sneyden trustee and denied the summary judgment on behalf of Garcia. The opinion of the Court of Appeals in this case, Your Honor, we believe is a landmark decision without precedent in the state of Texas. Among other things, it is held that a deed, a correction deed, cannot be used for any other purpose than to correct a scrivener's error in the misdescription of property. For the first time in the jurisprudence of this state, a court has held that it is legally impermissible to employ a correction deed to rectify a mutual mistake of the parties to the original grant unless the mistake is simply the misdescription of property. We believe that unless this decision is reversed, then the Court of Appeals decision will create havoc in the law of conveyancing in this state and will have a widespread deleterious effect on the land title law in this state. May I briefly relate to you the facts of the chronology of events as it affects this title. In May of 1977, Sneyden trustee conveyed the land in question to King and Simpson as grantee. Later in July of the same year, 1977, Sneyden apparently discovered that as a result of a mutual mistake of the parties, a deed restriction, which was intended by both parties to be employed in the deed, to wit, to reserve the use of the property as a first-class restaurant property for a period of 20 years, was omitted. Therefore, in July of 1977, they filed a correction deed, which stated that the restrictions would expire on January 1st, 1977. So we had a deed in May, a correction deed in July, and a correction deed which stated that the deed restriction would expire 7 months earlier than the correction deed. In December of 1981, a lease with an option to purchase the same land was given to one O'Neill. O'Neill's lease with option to purchase made specific reference to the restrictive covenants. Subsequently, in March of 1982, this lease and option to purchase was assigned by O'Neill to the respondent here, Garcia Enterprises, and this assignment specifically referred to the O'Neill assignment, which referred to the covenants. On April 18, 1985, apparently discovering that the first correction deed was in itself contained a typographical error, Sneyden filed a second correction deed. That second correction deed stated that the restrictions expired in 1997. In September of 85, Garcia exercised his option to purchase the property and acquired the land by general warranty deed. On the face of this conveyance, it states that it is subject to the restrictions contained in the original and subsequent correction deed. It states, and I quote, subject, however, to the following. One, restrictive covenants as recorded in volume and page deed records of Dallas County, Texas. And it further says, and I quote, each condition and covenant herein contained shall terminate and be of no further effect on January 1st, 1997. Those references to those restrictive covenants were in Garcia's deed in September 1985. The decisions of this court in the past have placed great emphasis on carrying out the intention of the parties to a deed by holding as a matter of law that a correction deed may be only implemented to correct a misdescription of property. The Dallas Court of Appeals has subverted the purpose of carrying out the intention of the parties, and that is to carry out what they intended in the first place, that the deed contain a restrictive covenant to permit the use of the property only for a restricted period until 1997. The opinion of the Court of Appeals has mistakenly characterized the attempt on the part of the grantor, Snedden, to correct a unilateral mistake. The opinion made great emphasis on the fact that Snedden could not, after he had granted the property, go back and unilaterally change the deal. Well, the summary judgment proof in this case unmistakably showed that the mutual intent of the parties to the original grant was that those restrictions were supposed to be in the deed. So in this case, the deed restrictions in the correction deed merely carried out the intention of the parties. This was supported by the affidavits of King and Simpson in support of the motion for summary judgment, neither of which was controverted. We intended that these deed restrictions would be in effect until January 1st, 1997.
That's between the grantor and the grantee.
That's correct.
That would be correction of a mutual mistake. But
that's
we're talking
correct.
Here about how it affects third party.
Well, third party, when he acquired his lease with option to purchase, was on notice that there were deed restrictions on the property, and we contend that a reasonable person would have been put on notice that nobody would have gone to the trouble to provide for deed restrictions on property which were to expire 7 months before the correction deed was filed. But if that didn't happen, when he exercised his option in 1985, he bought the property subject to the deed restriction. Now, much has been made about the fact that by a person taking title to a property with deed restrictions in it, he does not necessarily concede that those deed restrictions are valid. We will accept that as that is a proper statement of the law. A person may always take subject to deed restrictions and later challenge those restrictions under certain circumstances where the validity of the restrictions are in question. For instance, if one took a deed that imposed restrictions that amounted to taking of his property without due process, where the character of the neighborhood had drastically changed, that to continue to impose those restrictions would make the property useless, would affect take the grantee's property from him and make it useless to him, though under those circumstances, the deed restrictions may be invalid. They may violate the antitrust laws. They may violate the federal constitution. But here, the respondent and the plaintiff below was claiming that the deed restrictions were invalid because he didn't have notice of them. So we say that he had notice of them, but he's not challenging the validity of them. His only challenge to the validity is that he claims he didn't have notice. And he had noticed because it was in his chain of title when he bought the property. Here was a deed restriction that on its face showed that it expired 7 months before the correction deed was filed. And we say that that should incite a reasonable person into inquiring to determine whether or not those restrictions were still in effect. But if that doesn't do it, when he took the deed in September of 1985, these restrictions were written into his deed. And nothing is more basic to the law of conveyancing in the state of Texas than a person is bound by the terms of his own deed. Now, I think this leaves open the question of whether or not the restrictions are valid. The question we think that was before the trial court, in which we think the Court of Appeals misinterpreted, is whether or not he had notice of the restrictions. And if he takes with notice of the restrictions, if the deed restrictions are otherwise valid, his title is subject to restriction. We believe that the Court of Appeals, in saying that a correction deed may only be used to correct a scrivener's errors in the description of the property, is going to have a very unsettling effect on the law of this state with respect to conveyancing. And the Court of Appeals based its reasoning on the fact that it only found cases in the books that permitted correction of deeds for scrivener's and misdescription of property. Those are the only ones he found, and therefore the court reasoned that since these are the only ones they found, it must be impermissible. However, this court in 1986, in Andrews versus Koch, approved the order of a probate court to permit a correction deed which implemented an easement that had been omitted from the original grant. It would seem to us that an easement involves at least the same degree of burden on property as does restrictive covenants.
Did that case involve the rights of a third party? I don't believe it did, but
I'm not sufficiently familiar with the facts of that case. I can't tell you, Your Honor. I don't know. Irrespective of that, we believe that the omission of deed restrictions in the original grant were in fact scrivener's errors, and certainly the correction deed, which said that it expired in January 1st, 1977, was indeed a scrivener error. We believe that the opinion of the Court of Appeals further is erroneous in holding that Snayden had no authority to correct the mistakes by reason of the fact that he had already conveyed title to property. This is because we think the court viewed the mistake, mistakenly we believe, as a unilateral mistake. And the opinion of the Court of Appeals would subvert the ability of parties who have made a mutual mistake to rectify their mistake by a subsequent correction deed. The law of conveyancing the state of Texas, this court well knows, is based upon the law of recording and notice. And under our notice system, and I quote, whatever fairly puts a person on inquiry is sufficient notice where the means of knowledge are at hand, which if pursued by a proper inquiry, the full truth might have been ascertained. When Garcia took the assignment with the option to purchase, O'Neill's assignment and lease option was on record, and that made reference to the fact that there were certain restrictive covenants on that property. And Garcia's assignment specifically referred to O'Neill's assignment. We say that Garcia, when he purchased the option, his lease with option to purchase, he was on notice that there were restrictive covenants on that property. And a reasonable person, in going back and seeing a restrictive covenant that expired 7 months before the correction deed, would have exercised reasonable diligence and ascertained if those restrictive covenants were there. But if that didn't do it, when he took the deed in September 1985, he effectively ratified those restrictive covenants. And if he had a legal right to challenge the effectiveness of those restrictive covenants by taking the deed subject to the restrictive covenant, he waived that right. Garcia had until December 1986 to exercise his option. He chose to exercise it in 1985. He could have, if he'd gone to the title company and they say, here's your deed and where's your money, he could say, hold it. What is this business about restrictive covenants? He had time to make inquiry to decide, one, whether he wanted to exercise his option, or two, whether he wanted to go to court and determine their validity or their ethics. He did neither. He chose to close. We believe that the assignments and the title clearly would have put a reasonable person on notice to make inquiry to determine what was meant by these restrictive covenants that were to expire 4 months before the date of the original deed. Garcia is not, in our opinion, a bona fide purchaser. His deed was expressly subject to the first one. I'd like to repeat that, again, not to get mixed up, the difference between validity of the restrictive covenants and buying with notice of the restrictive covenants. Garcia's argument has always been the restrictive covenants, we were not on notice of the restrictive covenants, therefore they're invalid. But those are two different things. He has not challenged the validity except to say, I wasn't on notice of it. We believe that Garcia's contention that the restrictive covenants were not in this chain of title were also wrong. O'Neill's assignment was in his chain of title. He took an assignment from O'Neill, and he could have determined the fact that there were restrictive covenants and made inquiry even before we get to the question of taking the deed in September of 1985. The effective date of the correction deed, it relates back to the date of the original deed. So the law is that the correction deed relates back to the time of the original deed, Garcia is then on notice. In conclusion, Your Honor, we'd like to say that these parties and parties in the future should be permitted to effectively correct a deed when there is a mutual mistake. And again, we agree it can't be done for the purpose of, or where it prejudices the rights of third parties without notice. But here, before Garcia took his option with his lease with option to purchase, there were facts at hand in his chain of title which would have incited a reasonable person to inquire as to their validity and their efficacy. He didn't do so. Then time passed, and in September 1985, he chose 15 months earlier than he was required legally to exercise his option. He went to a closing table, and he took the deed subject to restrictions. We say if he wasn't on notice in 1981 or 82 when he took his lease, he certainly was on notice in 1985 and took a deed which was specifically subject to the restrictive covenant. This case, we believe, must be reversed in order to preserve the vitality of deed restrictions and the doctrine of notice and recordation and the right of parties when they discover a mutual mistake in a deed to go back and correct that deed in cases wherever, whatever kind of mistake it is, not just where there is some kind of facial scrivener's error in the misdescription of the property. We respectfully pray that the court reverse the opinion of the Court of Appeals dated May 20, 1988, and affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from the sponsor.
Please, the court, Tim Harbin.
May it please the court. My name is Tim Harvard, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent. The petitioners have urged this court, both in the brief and in their argument today, that a failure to reverse the Court of Appeals decision would have a deleterious effect and would, in fact, create havoc in the title industry and upon the laws of conveyancing in the state of Texas. The respondent would suggest to this honorable court that if the Court of Appeals decision is reversed, the very same effect would be achieved. The Court of Appeals decision, the essence of that opinion, recognize the simple fact that an optionee who has paid valuable consideration for that option is entitled to take title to the property in accordance with the terms of his option. Nothing more, but nothing less. And this court certainly must recognize that options constitute a very significant portion of the way Texas does real estate business. And if an optionee can be compelled to take title in such a circumstance, which is somehow diminished or restricted, from the date the option was granted to that optionee, that is going to have a very chilling effect on the way that Texas does business in the real estate area. Further, can you imagine the effect that it would have on the title industry if an examiner is required to deal with circumstances in which a predecessor in title may validly come in unilaterally, and by unilaterally I mean without the joinder of his grantee in the instrument, come in and place of record restrictions on a property some 8 years after that property has been transferred. I would suggest that that would have a very, very serious effect on the title industry. Now, the petitioner bases its appeal in essentially two areas. First of all, the propriety of a correction instrument, or the Court of Appeals holding that a correction instrument may not be utilized in these circumstances. And second area, on the Court of Appeals, its contention that the Court of Appeals erred in holding that the restrictive covenants are not binding on the grantee because there was no notice on the respondent in this case. Let me first address the correction instrument issue. It is the respondent's contention that even if this honorable court would hold that a correction instrument is the proper forum for dealing with a set of restrictive covenants which were inadvertently left off by mutual mistake, that still does not override the essential holding of the Court of Appeals, because that holding requires that an optionee not be made to take those restrictive covenants, subject to those restrictive covenants, when it had previously purchased the option.
Counsel, are you arguing the validity of the covenant or lack of notice? What is is your argument?
Your Honor, we would suggest that the restrictive covenants were not binding on the respondent in this case because it had neither actual nor constructive notice of the restrictive covenants at the time it purchased the option in April of 1982. And
certainly had notice in 1985.
Your Honor, there is no question but that the option, at the time the option was exercised in 85, our instrument set forth that it was bound or subject to those restrictive covenants, and also our title report told us that. But
there was no duty, at least there was no obligation for your client to go forward. He could have said, no, I will not accept those covenants, I will not close. I will not exercise my option.
Justice Gonzalez, that is certainly correct. However, realize that the respondent had paid $247,000 for that option in 1982. He was forced to a very tough decision. Do I exercise this option knowing that I may challenge the validity of those restrictions at a later time? Or do I walk away from the investment of a very considerable amount of money? Or thirdly, do I attempt to challenge it while I have a little bit of time left to go before my option expires? There is no question but that had they challenged it prior to the option expiring, there would have not been time to reach a result, to reach a conclusion. The respondent had obtained its financing, was ready to close, and closed knowing that he would have an opportunity to challenge the validity of those restrictive covenants. And that is the heart of the matter here. The optionee had paid $250,000 in 1982. And at that time, there was no notice of those restrictive covenants.
Well, you had notice that something was amiss because you had restrictive covenants that expired before the transaction even commenced.
Your Honor, first of all, I would call to this Court's attention that the restrictive covenants clearly were not in the chain of title on the instrument. This Court has long held the progression and definition of a chain of title. When an individual has conveyed his title away, he may not later place of record and some type of
or in any way deal with that property and to the detriment of a third party. That restrictive covenant was placed 2 months after the original instrument. I would direct the court's attention to the fact that the original conveyance between Snowden and the King of Simpson was perfect on its face. There was no inkling that there was a problem with that instrument. And after the time that King and Snowden held title of the property, Snowden, who is the petitioner in this case, cannot unilaterally, without the signature and joinder of King and Simpson, place these restrictive covenants of record. They are simply not in the chain of title. Therefore, there is no constructive notice to the respondent in this case.
You're saying that once you got your occupancy, anything that these other parties did after that would be in the middle of the case, even if they recorded it.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I would suggest to this court, the petitioner has asked rhetorically in its brief, what should we have done in this case? There are several things that could have been done in this case. There could have been a rescission with both the joinder of the grantee and grantor. They could have brought a suit for reformation of the instrument. They could have had a mutual cancellation of the instrument. And I would point out that, just as you suggest, from 1982, when the auctionee paid valuable consideration for that option, any modification or attempt to modify the title to that property must involve the auctionee. We should have been a party to any effort to change the title to the property.
Why was the consideration part of the lease payment? This was a lease with an option to purchase.
Your Honor, that is certainly true.
You've got something for your consideration. You've got use of the property.
That is certainly true, Your Honor. Although I am not eminently clear, I'm not certain that that was the only payment that was made in terms of there may have been continuing monthly obligations that were part of the rent. But certainly a large part of that consideration was for the right to buy the property at a higher price at a later time within the time period set forth in the auction.
So let me see if I understand your argument. You said that at the time of closing, you were very well aware that there had been a correction deed and there was a covenant.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that you chose to close and litigate the validity of those covenants later.
That is correct, Your Honor. Under the holding of Stout versus Rhodes, the petitioners attempted to differentiate that case from the facts at hand, and there is no distinction in that case. Stout versus Rhodes dealt with a purchaser who bought property subject to restrictive covenants. At the time he took the restrictive covenants, he knew about them, but he knew he had what he contended was a defense to those restrictive covenants. The circumstances of the property had changed. Well, we have a defense to the restrictive covenant being binding upon us. That is that we had no notice of them in 1982 when we paid valuable consideration for the option. At that point, does not become so much a question of notice. That is the distinction, excuse me, that the petitioner is attempting to make. The cases in our mind are very parallel.
I assume you made a conscious decision not to bring it to trade practice.
Your Honor, that is true. The reason being that the subject to provision in our warranty deed precluded us from suing our immediate grantor. There's no question about that. That was the purpose of the subject to provision. It was to protect that grantor on his warranty. But again, that is reason that we should not be precluded from asserting the real villain, if you will, in this case, a predecessor in title who 8 years after conveying the property placed the property, the deed restrictions on the property, very much to the detriment of the respondent.
Who drew that original deed that omitted that provision? Seller, buyer?
The initial instrument between Snowden and King and Simpson,
be frank, Your Honor, I'm unaware of who threw the document. But certainly the optionee was in no way involved and would have no knowledge of those circumstances. The petitioner has brought out circumstances which it contends that the option that we took somehow would have placed us on notice of the first set of restrictive covenants. First of all, we disagree strongly with that argument, and frankly, I'm not certain that the summary judgment evidence would show that there was any circumstances which would have placed us, by virtue of the option taken in 82, would have placed us on notice of previous restrictions that were filed in July of 1977. But even if they did, there could be other reasons why those restrictive covenants might have been filed of record. They may have been placed of record merely to show that at one time that property had been burdened with the restrictions and no longer was burdened with them. And it is unfair to require an optionee to look into those circumstances. They contend that it was such an obvious and open mistake that it put us on notice. Why wasn't it corrected until 8 years later, if it was so obvious and open? We would suggest that...
Counsel, can you speak to the argument that you ratified these covenants by going through the transaction after you were noticed for these covenants, the ratification argument that they made?
Your Honor, I certainly can. One of the principal cases that has been cited by the petitioners in this regard is Kunkel versus Kunkel. And in the Kunkel decision, the critical language that, in terms of dealing with a ratification, it requires the acceptance of the validity of the instrument. And that is the very heart of our argument, that under Stout versus Rhodes, we were not accepting the validity of the instrument. We were taking the property because we had a time period that was going to expire at some point in the future, and we knew we could subsequently challenge the instrument, which we did. We were in no way ratifying the validity of that restrictive covenant.
You've had 15 months. The case hadn't been final in that time. You sought injunctive
relief. Your Honor, that certainly was an option available to us. However, financing was in place at the time.
Did you have the financing in place before you? Is it your contention you had the financing in place before you discovered?
Well, Your Honor, at the time that the knowledge of this came to respondents, the time it came to the respondents' knowledge was when title reports were done. Financing had already been obtained. We were putting in wheels in motion the closing of the document, and title report revealed that the restrictive covenants were in place. And it is possible we could have initiated action at the time, maybe concluded it within the 15 months, but likely not. We have gotten not very far in the 2.5, nearly 3 years that this case has been on file thus far. So I think it's unreasonable to expect that any conclusion would have been obtained. We thought the proper form for challenging it would be by the property, knowing that we may later challenge it, which we sought to do. It is also analogous to the circumstances where I buy a piece of property that at one point in time has been leased by oil and gas, leased lessor, rather lessee. I buy the property subject to that oil and gas lease. Well, that lease may not have produced for years and years. I have a right to go in and seek to terminate the lease. But the purpose of the subject to provision in that oil in that instrument is so I can't sue my grantor on his breach of warranty. That is clearly the analogous, and we should be entitled to subsequently challenge the instrument, as we sought to do.
Why isn't your cause of action against O'Neill your option? If you obtain the option from O'Neill?
That is correct, Your Honor. The option was assigned through O'Neill, however, it was ratified, and fee title was in King and Simpson at the time. They ratified it, consented to it, and our immediate It was not O'Neill's fault that these restrictive covenants were subsequently placed of record. Even if we had had a right to go against O'Neill, there's no certainty that there would be any recovery from O'Neill. There's no certainty that the relief that we are really seeking in this case, it should be pointed out, after we bought the property, we initiated proceedings to get the restrictive covenant removed. That was done by virtue of a declaratory judgment action. Subsequently, it became necessary to sell the property, and at that time, after selling the property, we amended and alleged a complaint on the theory of slander of title. What my client really wanted at the outset of the lawsuit was to have the restrictions removed while he owned the property. And that was the reason that action was not taken against O'Neill.
So, Mr. Garcia, Joti Garcia's enterprises no longer own the property?
No, Your Honor, that is accurate.
So is Ms. Holdersham moot?
No, Your Honor, it is not.
What is your interest?
Well, the question is, at the time during our ownership of the property, should we have been bound by the restrictive covenants? And in particular, at the time we sold the property, should we have been bound by the restrictive covenants?
Aren't the new owners the real party interest here?
No, Your Honor, they're not.
Why not?
The issue that we are addressing is, should the respondent have been bound by the restrictive covenants during the time that it owned it? And in particular,
we're not to give advisory opinion. You know, if there is no real controversy between Joe Garcia and Mr. Darrell Snaden because he sold the property, whatever we write here, would that not be an advisory opinion?
Your Honor, it certainly would not, because we have a claim based on slander of title against.
But he no longer owned the title.
That is right. But we sold the property, and but for the restrictive covenants, we would have received a higher price for the property.
Right.
And in that regard, we should be entitled to obtain an opinion to the extent of were these binding upon us. And if they are not, it is our contention that we are entitled to damages as against Snaden for placing the restrictive covenants on the property. There are no further questions in the Honorable Court. Respectfully request the Court, upon considering the arguments today, the brief, the policy decisions at hand, and the law, uphold the Court of Appeals' decision.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Hey,
Ms. King, you want to tell us how you get around the staff case?
Yes, Your Honor. The staff case involved a circumstance where the purchasers of property were trying to avoid the effect of restrictive covenants based on changed circumstances. The court in that case held that by taking subject to, that they did not waive the right to challenge the validity. But I believe that the court said that by taking subject to, they were giving notice or receiving notice that those restrictions were of record, but they were not waiving the right to challenge the validity of those restrictions. In this case, the respondent has not raised one argument on the validity of the restrictions other than the fact that they did not have notice of those restrictions. So our contention is that Stout is not applicable here because Stout specifically says that by taking subject to, that constituted acknowledgement that, yes, those restrictions were of record. Respondent has raised no other argument as to validity of the restrictions in this case. So, therefore, by taking subject to, they did acknowledge that those restrictions were of record. They went ahead and took the deed, did not stop and take the opportunity at that point to sue their optioneer for damages, and thereby, under the case of Kunkel versus Kunkel, they gave up their options to ratify and waive any rights they had to contest the fact that they did not have notice of the restrictions, because they clearly did. As emphasized by co-counsel in Texas, competing rights and interests are governed by the notice and recording system. Respondent's argument obscures the governing effect of notice and recording system with respect to competing interests in real property by stressing general contract principles. True, solely in an action between an optionor and an optionee, the optionee may have the right to compel the sale of property on the terms stated in the option. But where the subject of the option is real property, there's still the governing effect of the system of notice and recording. Evidently, respondent hasn't challenged, he's contending that the Court of Appeals opinion, the basis of that is the fact that they had an option. He did not dispute the fact that a correction deed should be allowed to be used to correct other than the misdescription in property, but solely that because they had purchased this option, that nothing could be done to change what was found with no genuine issue of fact in the trial court to be a mutual mistake of grantor and grantee. In the summary judgment evidence, there was a question raised as to whether there was a fact issue. Clearly, that was just in the deposition of King, who was the grantee, Snaden's grantee. He could not remember how long the restrictions were to last, but later stated, after reviewing the documents, that yes, they were to last 20 years. So there was no fact issue that here, as between the grantor and the grantee who still owned the property at the time they took their option, there was no mistake, and these parties should have the right to go out and file a deed correcting that. At that time, their action would have been against their optionor, and they were not a necessary party to the change because they had an option. The courts have held that, or the courts have not held, but the cases indicate that a grantor need not have the signature of his grantee to go out and file a correction deed, particularly the case here where this has been shown to be the result of a mutual mistake concluded by the testimony of the grantee King himself as the key in the summary judgment evidence. Their argument further is that at the
counsel,
time...
Counsel, in that connection, excuse me, was Mr. Garcia represented in that deposition when both the grantor and grantee acknowledged that this was a mutual mistake?
Was he represented by counsel?
Yes, I'm just, this deposition, you're saying you're representing to the court that both the grantor and the grantee in the second correction deed acknowledged there was a mutual mistake with regards to the covenant. And this happened in a deposition. This deposition testimony.
In deposition testimony, they discussed the fact that, yes, it was a mutual mistake.
This is when after the lawsuit was filed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Garcia was...
I believe so, Your Honor. That's right. There was deposition testimony in the summary judgment evidence to that effect at the trial court level in this case.
I mean, that, the matter was not controversial. Whether it was deposition testimony or not, this issue of the mutual mistake between the grantor and grantee was not controverted by summary judgment evidence.
The respondent contended that because King couldn't remember in his deposition and later after reviewing documents did remember that there was a material issue of fact, but the trial court found that there wasn't. King simply said he could not remember the date of the restrictions. There were restrictions, he just couldn't remember how long they were to last. Later reviewed his documents and said, yes, the restrictions were to last 20 years. The respondents contend that because they did not have notice at the time they took the option, they aren't bound by the covenant. Again, the error was obvious. The deed, the original deed was not even dated. It was dated about 4 months after the covenants were to have expired. Further, the lease on which they took an option referenced those covenants or where they were filed of record, where they could have gone and checked them out. The respondents argued, well, we shouldn't have the burden to have to go and find out and inquire, but that's just exactly what the system of inquiry notice is all about. When they have the means of hand to go out and do a diligent inquiry and discover what is wrong, they do have a duty to do that, and they should be held to that burden.
Counsel, there's not much question but what the person who had the option could have refused to close. Could have perhaps sued your client for the Deceptive Trade Practices Act or a number of things. But if it's your contention that since he didn't do any of those before closing, that he in fact waived all of his rights by taking the deed and giving you the consideration at that stage of the game?
Yes, Your Honor. He purchased the property from the grantee. We're here representing the original grantor, Snaden. But it's our contention that when he took that deed that specifically set out that the covenants expired in 1997 and took that deed subject to those restrictions, he was acknowledging that, yes, there are these restrictions and they are of record. He may still challenge the right to their validity. I don't know what the statute of limitations is. but he cannot challenge that he did not know about them at that time, and by signing that deed, he therefore ratified the existence of the covenant and waived his right to say that he did not know about them at the time that he took the deed.
Well, this is a lawsuit that challenged those covenants. It's not. It started out as a declaratory judgment for court to declare that the covenants were invalid.
But, Your Honor, in distinguishing the Stout case, which is the case which, on which they rely for the right to challenge the covenant, that case states that by signing the deed subject to your notice, indicating that you're aware that those restrictions are of record, but you're not waiving the right to challenge the validity. And that case was the case involving changed circumstances in the neighborhood. That's something that would be akin to a challenge based on constitutional grounds or antitrust laws or something. But the respondent's only contention here is that they did not know that those restrictions were of record. It's only a notice challenge. And clearly, by signing a deed subject to restrictions expiring in 1997, they cannot now argue that at that point that they did not have notice. Because they had notice at the time they took the option, these restrictions were referenced in the lease that they took an assignment of. They were not required to be a party to the first correction deed. That was a mutual mistake between grantor and grantee. And because even if they did not have notice then, obviously they did not dispute that they signed a deed taking subject to restrictions expiring in 1997. Respectfully ask the court to reverse the